Action Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well, now you've got it.
Red, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hand of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given rights, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
All right, welcome to Free Association, Saturday afternoon here, just after 4 p.m. And makes it about 11 o'clock on the East Coast. And slightly earlier everywhere else, or slightly later in Australia. I don't keep track of the rest of the world all that much, but it's definitely 4 p.m. here. And it's a bit overcast. Reasonable temperature, about 5 or 6 degrees. 6 degrees, I think it is now, outside. So it's not great, but it's not icy. It's a good, solid spring day. And all being well, we'll have increases in temperature rather than decreases for the foreseeable future. And I'm in spring mode, so I'm waiting for the weather to catch up with me. But I've basically kind of gone into spring cleaning and rearranging my life mode, which I do occasionally, usually around about this time of year. I'm looking for new places to spend my time, new places to have coffee, new places to do podcasts from or whatever. I've got a portable setup today. So I've got a gadget called a PodTrack P4, which is on the floor. I'm in the living room. I'm not in the kitchen this week. I've got the laptop on the sofa. I've got the PodTrack P4 on the floor. Lots of wires going in and out. And a microphone on the stand to Shure SM48 PGA, I think it is, but it's a nice little microphone with an off-on switch on it, on a stand, and that's leaning up against me, but basically sitting on the sofa. So it's going to be me talking for the first few minutes, and then I'll play a little bit of video. Well, I'm rearranging what I'm doing with video clips as well, so I've taken the audio off there, and I'm going to work with it in a program called WavePad, which I've had for a little while. I don't really use it for the radio shows. I sometimes use it for the podcasts, but it's editing software, really, audio editing software. It's not particularly expensive. The free version lasts 30 days or so. You do have to buy a license if you want to do anything with it. I think it's about $30, $25, $30, something like that. It wasn't too bad anyway. And it's nice and simple. It's fairly straightforward. It does some audio. I can do some audio processing and some editing with it. So I'm playing with that at the moment. What that means is I'll maybe be changing the types of clips that I use and changing the length of the clips. Rather than being long clips, I might edit some short clips together and see and put half an hour together for the Saturday show that way. But I didn't have time today, so all I've got at the moment, I've got half a dozen clips, but they're all either 15 or 20 minutes or 25 minutes. So they're longer pieces. And so I'm going to need a day if I'm going to edit audio for the show. Doing it live is fine. I enjoy doing it live, and I enjoy the technical chaos that can ensue from a live radio show. But I think I'd rather have it technically working a bit better. I'm going to try and upgrade things technically a little bit. See how I get on with WavePad. And I've got a piece of software called Reaper as well, which is another audio editor, which I'm messing about with. At the moment, WavePad's the simplest way of doing this, because I can set it up so I've got 6 or 7 different clips in tabs, and then just tab through when I need to move along. Reaper looks a bit more complicated than that, so I think I'll stick with WavePad for the time being for the live shows and start editing things together a little bit for the podcast, see how that works, and incorporate Reaper into the podcast workflow that I've got to come up with. I've been speaking to somebody on Wednesday at a careers fair about potentially setting up a podcasting studio. I did a bit of research, and the going rate for an hour in a podcasting studio is £100 up here with a 2 hour minimum. So £200 per client is what would be happening. So it makes it a bigger operation. Makes it a bigger operation for me, because I'm going to have to do some technical stuff, and me and technology don't get on all that well. But I muddle through, but would you really want me in charge of producing a podcast for you? I don't think so, somehow. But I'm going to have to get over that kind of technical barrier somewhere down the line and just get stuck into it and bring somebody in to do editing if I need to, or bring somebody in to do the tech stuff. And we'll see how we go. At £100 an hour, I can afford to bring somebody in, but less than that, probably going to have to do it myself. Anyway, so I was speaking to this guy. I've got his business card in the pocket of my other jeans, which are now in the bathroom, waiting to go into the laundry. So on Wednesday, I went to a careers fair up at the football ground, St. James's Park, one of their function rooms. So there was quite a lot of activity up there. Started at 10 o'clock. I think it ended at 2. I went up almost 10 o'clock to the minute. I think it was about 2 or 3 minutes past 10 by the time I got up there. And there was already people going in. So it was a busy operation with about a dozen or maybe 15 different companies set up with stalls, giving out leaflets and talking to people as they go through, and basically lead generation for these particular companies, training companies, companies that are recruiting directly, some independent recruiters as well, and some training companies that do certificates and things like that for call center work, and then get you in because you've got a certificate. So they're getting money from the employer, and they're training you, and you go in because you've been trained, basically. So a way of cutting through the recruitment process a little bit. So I've got some leaflets. I was speaking to a guy from Launch Group, And they've got a training course coming up with the Automobile Association, which is about half a mile's walk from where I live on Newcastle Business Park. So I may go for one of their training courses at some point. Probably not the one in March, but maybe April. I'll take a look at when it's a little bit warmer and a little bit like early morning friendly. It could be a 7 o'clock start or an 8 o'clock start at the Automobile Association. So I need it to be a bit warmer, quite honestly. If I'm gonna give my time to somebody, I want it to be close by and easy to get to and not freezing when I'm doing it, ideally. So that's one possibility. The other possibility, as I said, is the podcast studio, which I would need to get some kind of funding. If I'm going to set up a studio, I would need to get funding from somewhere. All right, thanks, Mist. I appreciate the feedback. I did double check on Skype, and it looked all right, but it's good to know that the audio is doing good. And hello to Captain Fred as well in the chat. Net Effect. And yeah, so I'm kind of changing the technical side of things a little bit on here. And looking at change, I'm going to have to go back to work because I've run out of money. So I need to go back to work for a little while and pay off my debts and get my head sharp again. My head's pretty sharp at the moment, but I need to kind of fine-tune everything. So plan A is the podcast studio business plan. Plan B is launch group to get me into the Automobile Association for an 8 till 7:15 job. I think it's somewhere between those hours. And Saturday work and that one as well. So if I go for that, I would have to change the time of the show. So I can potentially move the show a bit later if I end up working for the AA. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. It's all a bit, it's a little bit up in the air. It's all hypothetical, but it happens the way it happens. So of the clips that I've got set up, I think the one I want to play is the most recent one, which is the Jeffries. Ooh, why is that doing that? Let's have a look. Let's not duplicate it. Alright, so this is Jeffrey Sachs and Ray McGovern at the United Nations Security Council about 3 days ago, I think. It's half an hour. I'll play the first part. I'll play the Jeffrey Sachs part and then see how I feel about the second half.
The provisional agenda for this meeting is threats to international peace and security. The agenda is adopted. In accordance with Rule 39 of the Council's Provisional Rules of Procedure, I invite the following briefers to participate in this meeting. Ms. Rosemary DiCarlo, Under Secretary General for Political and Peace Building Affairs. Mr. Jeffrey Sachs, Professor and Director of the Center for Sustainable Development, Earth Institute at Columbia University, and Mr. Rain McGovern, Political Activist. It is so decided. The Security Council will now begin its consideration of item 2 of the agenda. I now give the floor to Ms. Rosemary DiCarlo.
Thank you, Mr. President. On 30 September last year, Assistant Secretary General for Economic Development at the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, Navid Hanif, briefed this council on the reported links in the Nord Stream pipelines. His briefing was based on information and data from publicly available sources. My briefing today is also based on publicly available information that we have to date. As Assistant Secretary General Hanif said in September, in the course of 26 to 29 September 2022, four leaks were detected in the Nord Stream undersea pipelines in the Baltic Sea near the island of Bornholm. The first leak was reported on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline in the morning of 26 September, when seismologists detected a spike in activity. The second and third leaks were reported in the evening of 26 September on the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. A fourth leak was reported the morning of 29 September on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Neither pipeline was in operation. Supplies in Nord Stream 1 had been halted in September, while Nord Stream 2 never entered service. However, the pipelines reportedly held several hundred million cubic meters of natural gas at the time of the incidents. Following the incidents, Danish, German, and Swedish officials announced they would launch separate investigations into the leaks. The Russian Federation expressed interest in joining these investigations, while also expressing concern that a deliberate act of sabotage and terrorism might be to blame for the explosions that caused the leaks. On 18 October, Copenhagen police reported that a preliminary investigation into the leaks found that powerful explosions caused the damage. A month later, on 18 November, the Swedish Security Service and Prosecution Authority reported that, according to their preliminary findings, the pipelines had been subject to gross sabotage. Swedish officials stated that, in the investigations carried out on site in the Baltic Sea, investigators documented extensive damage to the gas pipelines resulted from detonations. Swedish authorities also said they had seized foreign items and that explosive residue was identified on a number of those items. According to officials quoted in local media, the investigation is ongoing. On 4 February 2023, the German Attorney General stated that their investigation was also continuing. We understand that the Danish investigation is continuing as well. Further, we are aware of new reports alleging acts of sabotage involving the two pipelines. I reiterate that the United Nations is not in a position to verify or confirm any of the claims relating to these incidents, and that we await the findings of the ongoing national investigations. Given the sensitivity and speculation regarding this issue, we urge all concerned to show restraint and avoid any speculation. We should avoid any unfounded accusations that could further escalate the already heightened tensions in the region and potentially inhibit the search for the truth. And while we don't know exactly what happened beneath the waters of the Baltic Sea in September 2020, one thing is certain. Whatever caused the incident, its fallout counts among the many risks the invasion of Ukraine has unleashed. 1 year since the start of the war, we must redouble our efforts to end it, in line with international law and the UN Charter. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank Ms. DiCarlo for her briefing, and I now give the floor to Mr. Jeffrey Sachs.
Thank you very much. My name is Jeffrey Sachs. I am university professor at Columbia University. I'm a specialist in the global economy, including global trade, finance, infrastructure, and economic statecraft. I appear before the UN Security Council on my own behalf. I represent no government or organization in the testimony that I will deliver. The destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines on September 26, 2022 constitutes an act of international terrorism and represents a threat to the peace. It is the responsibility of the UN Security Council to take up the question of who might have carried out the act in order to bring the perpetrator to international justice, to pursue compensation for the damaged parties, and to prevent future such actions. The consequences of the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines are enormous. They include not only the vast economic losses related to the pipelines themselves and their future potential use, but also the heightened threat to transboundary infrastructure of all kinds, submarine internet cables, international pipelines for gas and hydrogen, transboundary power transmission, offshore wind farms, and more. The global transformation to green energy will require considerable transboundary infrastructure, including in international waters. Countries need to have full confidence that their infrastructure will not be destroyed by third parties. Some European countries have recently expressed concern over the safety of their offshore infrastructure. For all of these reasons, the investigation by the UN Security Council of the Nord Stream explosions is a high global priority. The destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines required a very high degree of planning, expertise, and technological capacity. The Nord Stream 2 pipelines are a marvel of engineering. Each section of pipe is rolled steel of 4.5 centimeters thickness and with a pipeline internal diameter of 1.15 meters. The pipe is encased in concrete of 10.9 centimeters thickness. The weight of each section of concrete encased pipe is 24 metric tons. The Nord Stream 2 pipelines, some 1,200 kilometers in length, contain around 200,000 pipes. The pipelines sit on the sea floor. Destroying a pipeline of heavy rolled steel encased in concrete at depths of 70 to 90 meters requires a highly advanced technology for transportation of the explosives, diving to install the explosives, and detonation. To do so undetected in the exclusive economic zones of Denmark and Sweden adds greatly to the complexity of the operation. As a number of senior officials have publicly confirmed, an action of this sort must have been carried out by a state-level actor. Only a handful of state-level actors have both the technical capacity and access to the Baltic Sea to have carried out this action, include the United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, Poland, Norway, Germany, Denmark, and Sweden, either individually or in some combination. Ukraine lacks the necessary technologies as well as access to the Baltic Sea. A recent report by the Washington Post revealed that the intelligence agencies of the NATO countries have privately concluded that there is no evidence whatsoever that Russia carried out this action. This also comports with the fact that Russia had no obvious motive to carry out this act of terrorism on its own critical infrastructure. Indeed, Russia is likely to bear considerable expenses to repair the pipelines. Three countries have reportedly carried out investigations of the Nord Stream terrorism: Denmark, Germany, and Sweden. These countries presumably know much more about the circumstances of the terrorist attack. Sweden, in particular, has perhaps the most to tell the world about the crime scene, which its divers investigated. Yet instead of sharing this information globally, Sweden has kept the results of its investigation secret from the rest of the world. Sweden has refused to share its findings with Russia and turned down a joint investigation with Denmark and Germany. In the interest of global peace, the UN Security Council should require these countries to immediately turn over the results of their investigations to the UN Security Council. There is only one detailed account to date of the Nord Stream destruction, the one recently put forward by investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, ostensibly based on information leaked by Hersh by an unnamed source. Hersh attributes the Nord Stream destruction to a decision ordered by U.S. President Joe Biden and carried out by U.S. agents in a covert operation that Hersh describes in detail. The White House has described Hersh's account as, quote, completely and utterly false, unquote, but did not offer any information contradicting Hersh's account and did not offer any alternative explanation. Senior U.S. officials made statements before and after the Nord Stream destruction that showed the U.S. animus towards the pipelines. On January 27, 2022, Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland tweeted, quote, if Russia invades Ukraine, one way or another, Nord Stream 2 will not move forward, end quote. On February 7th, President Biden said, quote, If Russia invades again, then there will be no longer Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it, end quote. When asked by the reporter how he would do that, he responded, quote, I promise you we will be able to do it, end quote. On September 30th, 2022, immediately following the terrorist attack on the pipeline, Secretary of State Antony Blinken declared that the destruction of the pipeline is, quote, also a tremendous opportunity. It's a tremendous opportunity to once and for all remove the dependence on Russian energy and thus to take away from Vladimir Putin the weaponization of energy as a means of advancing his imperial design, end quote. On January 28, 2023, Undersecretary Nuland declared in testimony to Senator Ted Cruz in the U.S. Senate, quote, I am, and I think the administration is, very gratified to know that Nord Stream 2 is now, as you like to say, a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea, end quote. Such language is not at all appropriate in the face of international terrorism. I hope that the United States, together with all other Security Council members, will condemn this act of international terrorism and join together in an urgent UN Security Council-led investigation of this international crime in order to determine the truth. The truth is not yet known by the world, but it is knowable. More than ever, the world depends on the UN Security Council to do its work to stop the escalation to a new world war. The world will be safe only when the permanent members work together diplomatically to solve global crises, including the war in Ukraine and the rising tensions in East Asia. The UN Security Council provides the unique global venue for that peace-affirming work. More than ever, we need a healthy, functioning UN Security Council carrying out the mission assigned to it by the UN Charter. A UN Security Council objective investigation of the Nord Stream terrorism, in which all countries contribute what they know, is important for the global confidence in this body, and most importantly, for global peace and sustainable development. Thank you very much.
I thank Mr. Sachs for his...
All right. Jeffrey Sachs is an interesting guy, and he seems to get around quite a lot. If he's testifying to the United Nations Security Council, then he's obviously a serious man. They take him seriously, and I take him seriously as well. So the next guy on this testimony, evidence gathering session or whatever you want to call it, is a guy called Ray McGovern, who's a former CIA security analyst.
For his briefing, and I now give the floor to you, Mr. Raymond McGovern.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I would associate myself completely with Professor Sachs's comments. I do not have a prepared text, and so I was unable to give that to the people who asked me to give it to them. I was asked to do this less than a day ago. No one suggested what I might say. And, of course, no one even asked me what I would say. So these are my personal remarks based on my experience for 27 years as an intelligence analyst and as an observer. And I noticed that I'm called a political activist. Well, this is my way of paying back for the education I got as an intelligence analyst in the U.S. intelligence community. Now, I would say that on my way here in two airports this morning, I noticed a bunch of children, little children and school-age children, and it made me think back to my days as a school-age child. I was one of those who hid under my desk because of the threat of the Russian atom bomb, as though that would protect me. Fast forward. When I became a professional analyst and chief of the Soviet Foreign Policy Branch at CIA, I was able to tell the president and Henry Kissinger that the Russians were really interested in putting a cap on the arms race. Suffice it to say, I was instrumental in the anti-ballistic missile treaty signed in May of 1972. I was there. 30 years of strategic stability. 30. Count them, three decades. When Mr. Bush Jr. decided he would leave the ABM treaty without any real explanation. And then Mr. Trump left the INF treaty, which I thought could never be concluded because it involved the destruction of a whole class of nuclear-tipped intermediate-range ballistic missiles in Europe and in Siberia. Then we had the Open Skies Treaty, from which the U.S. left. And now we are warned that the new START is also in danger. I must say that after the anti-ballistic missile treaty was signed, I was feeling euphoric. I need not worry about whether they're building this building just to be demolished by the next nuclear weapon. And it's very sad for me to watch what's going on now, where people can't get together and deal. Verhandeln. That's the German word for negotiate, deal. If you look at it, it comes from the word hunt. Die Hand. Die Hand. You reach out die Hand and you get to know and you get to understand what is bothering the other party. Now, I don't want to get ahead of myself here. I do want to talk about Seymour Hersh's article, and I can have to say up front, full disclosure, that I am a friend of Seymour Hersh, and so I will not opine myself. I will cite a very distinguished former U.S. ambassador and also Assistant Secretary of Defense. These are the words he said about Seymour Hersh. Hersh attracts whistleblowers because he has a perfect record of protecting their identities and accurately publishing what they reveal after due diligence, despite the government denials and slanderous attacks that invariably follow. His reputation is such that people of conscience seek him out. People of conscience. As a U.S. Army officer and as a CIA employee, I took an oath, one oath. It was to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Some of us took that oath seriously. And when we see this kind of thing going on, we go to somebody who might be able to protect us and might be able to get the word out. Now, this was 2 weeks ago. Has the New York Times mentioned Cy Hersh's article? Has it even reported the denials? No, not yet. This is quite, the Germans would say, merkwürdig. This is very, very remarkable. Now, let me go on here and talk about, how do we evaluate those who are smearing Seymour Hersh? Well, as Jeffrey Sachs has already said, the CIA spokesperson said, the claim is completely and utterly false, quote, end quote. Whoa! Now, I have to confess, being an alumnus of the CIA, that our PR people, our public relations people, do not have a very good record. No one wants to go back 20 years to Colin Powell's speech before this Security Council. We all know about that. What I would like to do is simply say, what happened before that speech? Before that speech, some conscientious whistleblower gave the text of a UN debriefing of Hussein Kamel, one of Saddam Hussein's sons-in-law. And who was he? He was supervisor over the radiological, biological, chemical, and nuclear program such as it was in Baghdad. And he said to his interviewers, UN interviewers, U.S. interviewers, U.K. interviewers, he said the following. All nuclear, chemical, biological, and missile programs have been destroyed. Now, they asked him, the interrogators did, well, how do you know? And Kamel said, well, I was in charge of them. I mean, I don't know how it works in your country, but when I order something destroyed, it gets destroyed. Yeah, how do you know? Did you check? Well, yeah, I checked a couple. Are you trying to get me to say they were not destroyed? This is 1995. Now, someone leaked that transcript to Newsweek. Newsweek on the 24th, almost exactly 20 years ago, Newsweek published this report saying, Hussein Kamel, the highest-ranking Iraqi official ever to defect from Saddam Hussein's inner circle, told the CIA and British intelligence officers and U.S. inspectors in the autumn of 1995 that after the Gulf War, Iraq destroyed all its chemical and biological weapons and the missiles to deliver them. Kamel had direct knowledge of what he claimed. For 10 years, he ran Iraq's nuclear, chemical, biological, and missile programs. And in a classic understatement, the author, John Barry, in Newsweek says, the defector's tale raises questions about whether the WMD stockpiles attributed to Iraq still exist. Well, I guess. What happened? Newsweek published this in a little blurb, first on their site, their website. Then the members of the media went to a fellow named Bill Harlow, who was CIA PR person, CIA spokesperson for the agency. And he said, look, this report is incorrect, it's bogus, it's wrong, and it's untrue. Whoa. Incorrect, bogus, wrong, and untrue. And what did the members of the press do? They breathed a sigh of relief and said, whew, I'm sure glad you told us that, because we were going to publish on that. It looked pretty documentary. It looked pretty authoritative. It was indeed the transcript of that debriefing. Now, just a word about those who are smearing Cy Hirsch. They don't have a really good record for credibility. Let me move on here. I'd like to talk a little bit about unprovoked. Now, we have heard more than 100 times that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was unprovoked. This goes back to the widening of NATO despite the promise not to. And I had a personal experience with one of Gorbachev's chief advisors. His name is Kuvaldin Viktor Borisovich. And about 8 years, I saw him in Moscow, and I said, Viktor, I said, Mr. Kuvaldin, why is it that this agreement was not written down? And he said, Mr. McGovern, I'll tell you, the usual reasons. The Germans hadn't bought into it yet, and the Warsaw Pact still existed. But really and truly, Mr. McGovern, here's what it was. We trusted you. Now, we all know the history of how NATO more than doubled in size, with all countries to the east, more than one inch to the east. I want to not belabor that point. It's simply that, it's more than just NATO enlargement. When the Crimea was annexed by Russia, Putin got up a month later and he said,
We had to annex Crimea because of the coup in Kiev in February of 2014. And even more important than NATO membership for Ukraine was the prospect that medium-range ballistic missiles would be put on the periphery of the United States, which indeed they are capable of doing because there are capsules, holes in Romania and Poland that accommodate Tomahawk missiles, cruise missiles, and will eventually accommodate hypersonic missiles. This is very, very serious. Mr. Putin made this point in December of last year, not last year, but the year before, in talking to his chief military. Now, how do I end this? I would like to do a little human business here. Let me just point out that when I was in Germany last, there was a button that one put on the lapel, on the lapel, and it said, Putin verstehe. Okay? Now, those of you who know German know that that means someone who understands Putin. And I thought to myself, wow, somebody is interested in understanding Mr. Putin? And my friend said, no, Ray, for God's sake, don't wear that button. That's a pejorative. That means you're in Putin's pocket. Now, verstehen comes from the word stehen, to stand, okay? If you can't understand where people stand, you can't understand what bothers them. And what bothers Mr. Putin, as well as membership in NATO for Ukraine, is the emplacement of these holes already operational in Romania and Poland, right on the periphery of the United States. They are disguised as ABM systems, but they can easily be put accommodate cruise missiles and, as I say, hypersonic missiles. Now, there was a motto.
I'm going to stop him there. He does go on to sing a little bit, so I think it's probably wise to not play the singing, but it's on the original video. If you want to check out Ray McGovern's singing, then that is on the original video. I'm not going to play it here, though. So what am I going to talk about now? I don't really know. I had six videos lined up, but there's not time to play anything else. I could talk about Nicola Sturgeon. Nicola Sturgeon resigned as was she Prime Minister, First Minister of Scotland this week, and she's been getting herself into trouble trying to define what a woman is to include people who used to be men or might still be men, technically speaking. So she got herself into trouble. She's also in political trouble in Scotland, so she's retiring early before it all catches up with her. So that's the main thing that was interesting to me at the beginning of the week. Yeah, I've got a show to do with Chris Wilson after this one, I spoke to him on Monday. I think the topic today is Nazis in Antarctica after the Second World War and the fighting that went on with MI5 in Antarctica. I don't know anything about it. I knew there was Nazis in Antarctica, but I don't know the details. So I'm going to catch up on the details after this show. And Chris is doing a briefing, hopefully about an hour, maybe an hour and a quarter. And we're doing regular shows, and he's picking up a little bit of an audience on Spotify and Podbean. So it's boosting my downloads a little bit. The downloads are a bit low at the moment, so I need to figure out a way to kind of click into the Spotify algorithm again. Compared to where I was a year and a bit ago, I think I had one download yesterday, so I need to figure out some way of marketing the podcast, but at some point there'll be a network of people who are all promoting each other, and that's when things really kind of take off, because if you've got people promoting you and you're promoting them, then it adds to everybody along the way. And I've been describing myself as an international podcasting superstar, which is a bit optimistic, but it is what it is. It's kind of what I am, if depending on how you define superstar. But international and podcasting, definitely superstar. I'm obviously known in the States and Australia and a couple of countries in Europe. So I think international podcasting superstar is fairly accurate. Yeah, we'll see where we go. Let me have a look on BitChute and see if there's anything worth catching up on BitChute. If I can open the window with one arm tied behind me back. Here we go. Let's see. All right, so I'll tell you what else I can talk about. There's a cup final tomorrow. So Newcastle United, which is the local football team, are playing in the what used to be the League Cup final against Manchester United at, I think about 4 o'clock, something like that. I'll have to double-check the start time. I did say I would go around to my neighbours to watch it. But I may go to a bar. It depends how I feel. We shall see. So let's have a quick look at YouTube. Right, you probably can't hear what I'm saying, but I'm just muttering to myself, and if I find anything that's worth playing. There's been plenty of Scott Ritter over the past few days. I'll play a little bit of Scott Ritter. This is just showing up on BitChute. So
I want to start by running a little bit of a clip from President Putin's speech, in which he basically says what you have been saying, which is that the West started the war. They started it. Gary, the
Kiev regime provided artillery aviation and other weapons to attack Donbass back in 2014. In 2015, they attempted again to directly attack Donbass. They continued shelling, terror in relation to citizens. All of this was completely against the documents that were accepted by the United Nations Security Council. I would like to repeat, they started the war. And we used the force in order to stop it.
You surprised to hear President Putin say that directly? Is that for international consumption or domestic consumption? What do you think?
Well, I mean, this is the Russian equivalent of the State of the Union address. So its primary audience is domestic. Putin knows that the world is watching, which is why he, at the end of it, he made his announcement regarding Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty and the suspension. But this is for domestic consumption, and I think he's basically just cutting to the chase, telling all those people out there in Russia right now who hem and haw about, you know, why are we in Ukraine? What are we doing? He's making it quite clear that from the Russian perspective, this war was started by Ukraine, by the West, and Russia had no choice. And Russia is now going to finish this war. They didn't start it, but they will finish it.
I actually thought he was a little, I don't want to sound like the nationalists against him, but almost a little timid. I mean, he could have pointed out the eastward movement of NATO, contrary to the promises of George H.W. Bush and Jim Baker to his predecessor, Mikhail Gorbachev. He didn't go there. But since you mentioned the suspension of the START treaty, well, this is your field, Scott, weapons inspection. We'll run that clip, and then I want to ask you about this. Take a listen to the words he uses, theater of the absurd. I don't even know if there's a Russian word for that. Gary's going to raise the volume in Russian. It's almost like he's saying theater of the absurd in English with a Russian accent. Take a listen.
In the beginning of February this year, there was a statement from the North Atlantic Alliance factually demanding that Russia returns to the Strategic Arms Treaty, as they call it, including allowing inspections of our nuclear defense facilities. I don't even know what to call it. It's a theater of the absurd. Regarding this, I have to say that Russia suspends its participation in the New START Treaty.
Surprise. Well, first tell us what the START Treaty is. Second, tell us how, if at all, dangerous to the West it is at his suspension. Third, address the significance of suspension rather than termination. And then if you want, you could talk about, I don't know how to say this with a Russian accent, theater of the absurd.
we'll start with the New START Treaty. The Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty was one of the most important arms control endeavors undertaken by the United States and the former Soviet Union, and then later on Russia. It helped draw down the massive quantities of strategic nuclear weapons that both sides had, from the tens of thousands down to, I mean, right now we're talking about 1,550, which is the limit. And if anybody doesn't understand the implications of that, then I can't help you. To go from 30,000 strategic nuclear weapons to 1,550 is a big deal.
How do we know that that's their number, and how do they know that that's our number?
Well, see, this is the key aspect of arms control: trust but verify. This is what I used to do. I was in the verification business, and my job was to go in and on the ground, eyeballs on target, engage my brain, and ensure that the Russians or the Soviets at the time were doing that which they were required to do. They were doing the same with us. These on-site inspections are an integral part of any treaty verification process, and it's essential. I don't know how many times I need to say that or underscore it, that they be allowed to continue, and they're not right now. They're suspended. And this is, you know, the Russians made the point. Look, back in, I think, February 2020, both sides agreed that because of the pandemic, that they were going to stop inspections. And they were going to stop the formal meetings because, you know, the idea of getting people together like that face to face at the time was, you know, frightening. And in early 2022, both sides started talking about, hey, maybe it's time we get back into doing this. But the problem for the Russians was, in order for them to send inspections to the United States, they have to overfly Europe. And Europe said, no Russian aircraft will be overflying. We have sanctions. And the Russians went, well, how do we implement this treaty? And the Americans are like, well, that's your problem, not our problem. And then when the Americans tried to send inspectors over, the Russians went, time out, pal. If we can't do it, you can't do it. And then both sides started to talk about it. And then they were going to have this meeting of the BCC, they call it, a consultative committee for the treaty, in Cairo, Egypt, because Switzerland had lost its neutrality status, according to the Russians, by supporting the EU against Russia. So they're going to meet in Cairo. But at the last second, the Russians pulled out. What they said is, hey, you know, you guys are engaged in the business of trying to destroy us. You've said it straight up. You want to strategically defeat Russia. And you backed out of the ABM treaty, the anti-ballistic missile treaty. And so we built missiles to defeat your missile system. And now you want to destroy us and send inspectors in to inspect our missiles that we built to defeat your missile system while you won't let us inspect. That's just not the game we're going to play. So we're suspending this right now. Russia says that they will continue to abide by their obligations, but there won't be any on-site inspections. There won't be any exchange of data. There won't be anything. And this treaty expires in 2026. And if they don't have another treaty on the deck to replace it, we're in for an arms race that could lead to literally the end of the world.
Right. On that note, we're coming up to the end of the show. So I've just got to remind you that Revolution Radio is listener supported. We do rely on donations. So you can make a donation if you've got some spare cash, either a one-off donation or a monthly donation at revolution.radio or freedomslips.com. If you have a look on the menu, there's a page with a whole long list of ways you can make donations, including cryptocurrency and via two or three different payment processing companies. So there's a way to do it, and we encourage you to do it. And there's two studios running almost 24 hours a day. Studio A runs pretty much continuously. Studio B is about 18 hours a day, something like that. The Hawk's Nest's got two or three shows, a couple of shows on it, including one that I've got listed that I don't really do. So I'm gonna change that around and see if I can come up with a different format and maybe a different time for the Hawk's Nest show. That's more likely to happen. Because it's a bit too late for me, 10 o'clock. If it gets me wound up with me, then I can't sleep, so I need to rethink it. But that's more or less it for today. So thanks for the people who are listening in the chat room. Thanks to everybody who's listening on the podcast. There's 253 people now on my podcast subscribers list on Podbean, which I don't think is bad. I think that's pretty good. I think that justifies me using the words international podcasting superstar. That's pretty much it. Thanks for listening. I've got a show to do with Chris Wilson, so if anybody wants to hop onto Podbean, we'll be live in about 5 minutes' time. I'm going to take a quick break and then jump straight on with Chris. All right, see you next week. Thanks for listening, and have a good week.
It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
There have been imaginative science fiction writers for generations.
Be invasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
I'm aware of some archaeologists that have uncovered large bones indicating giants in Virginia. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford. Join me every Thursday night in Studio A at 6 p.m. Eastern for Factor Theory Live. Find us on www.revolution.radio. Great guests and great stories.
What do you believe?
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law, spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings.